All right. Thank you, Luke Barr, for being for on Ride On Radio today. Luke is
Thank you.
here
Thank you for
to
inviting me.
talk about his recently released book, The Secret History of French Cooking, The Outlaw Chefs Who Made Modern Food. And just to get us started, Luke, can you describe why did you want to write this book specifically?
I feel like nouvelle cuisine is something that I know what it is, but a lot of people don't know what it is. And then also, if you do know what it is, you think of it as a preposterous fad from the 70s, something totally ridiculous. Like, okay, tiny little portions of food on the plate, strange fruits combined with meats or whatever. That was the cliche of nouvelle cuisine. And what I realized was, no, in fact, nouvelle cuisine was the origin of so much of how restaurants are today. So much of modern food, restaurant cooking, and our food culture comes from this late 60s, early 70s moment that was called nouvelle cuisine. And so that struck me as a good topic for a book because it was sort of an unknown, sort of unknown territory, and something that was sort of consigned to, like I said, consigned to being a ridiculous fad, whereas in fact it was much more than that. So that's the starting point. That was the starting point for my research. And then, and it was fascinating. The original idea in, just to speak very, very broadly, was that before the late 60s, if you were a chef in a classic French kitchen, and by the way, before the late, I mean, the best restaurants were always French restaurants in the 50s and 60s in America and even around the world. Like, a great restaurant was a French restaurant. And those restaurants all served the same menu. Basically, they served the classic dishes that Auguste Escoffier had invented or perfected, decades earlier in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And those were that was the duck a l'orange. That was all the classic, mother sauces. All the classics of French cooking hadn't changed. And yet here we are, in the late 1960s, post May 68, student protests, a whole kind of new culture in the air. And there was a new generation of chefs who were like, wait a sec, why do I need to just keep on making that same classic dish the same way it's always been made? Why can't I do something more creative? Why can't I invent a new dish, let's say? Or what if I, discover a new herb or some sort of flavor combination or any, that was the idea, the kind of to find a kind of freedom in the kitchen. Of course, we take this for granted now. If you go to a restaurant, and the chef presents you with her, newly designed, trademark, famous dish, you're not going to be surprised. Like, wow, why is she making something that's new and incorporates, I don't know, flavors from Thailand or whatever it is. Like, that's something we just take for granted. But that was not the case in the late 60s, early 70s, and that's what the nouvelle cuisine movement was all about.
So my follow-up question for this was, what kind of research did you do for this kind of book? Because I'm looking at like, oh, there's some cool old menus, there's a lot of cool photos in the book. What was like that process to like? Was it kind of easy to find these kind of portions of media? Was it a little bit difficult? Where did you look?
Okay, I mean, it was fantastic research, by the way. I mean,
Yeah,
I
thank you.
traveled to France. I interviewed a whole bunch of people. That was fantastic. There was a lot of sort of archival type research as well. And compared to my previous book, okay, this is my third book. My previous book was called Ritz and Escoffier, and it was about the late 19th century. And that really was, well, first of all, obviously completely archival. You can't talk to anyone. And the archives are quite buried. I mean, you'd think, okay, London in the late 19th century had a thriving press. There was multiple newspapers and huge amounts of articles being written every day, including about the Savoy Hotel and the people that I was researching. But finding those articles was quite difficult. Whereas writing about the 60s and 70s, it's much more accessible. So yeah, there was quite a bit of archival research looking into newspapers, and then also interviewing people. As I started the process, I thought, okay, I'm going to be interviewing these Nouvelle Cuisine chefs, the famous, they're most of them, a lot of them had died, but Michel Girard was still alive, Pierre Troigros was still alive, two of the main sort of iconic figures. And I did interview them. As I was doing the research, I discovered there was this group of women chefs who came up at the same time in the 70s and who were barred from joining the Association of French Chefs and various other sort of, bureaucratic institutions that safeguarded French cuisine. They were not allowed entry. And so they created their own organization called the ARC in the mid 70s to promote women chefs and women cooking in the and women's kitchens and so forth. And a lot of those women were still alive. And so I trekked around France interviewing them as well. And that's sort of, that's another level of the story. That's also why I call it the secret history. I mean, Nouvelle Cuisine is not a secret. I feel like it's been sort of misconstrued. But the story of these women chefs and the ARC is a secret. No one really remembers that or knows about that. And so, yeah, so that was my research. It was a combination of archival stuff, interviews in France. And also in here too, by the way. I mean, my book does not entirely take place in France. There's a whole component in the States. I interviewed Ruth Reichel or various other people here in the States who remembered, what happened in the 70s. And so, yeah, interviews and archival research. Yeah.
So I also wanted to talk a little bit about the portion that goes back to the States, because the first thing that I think of in like this kind of movement as an American, my first thought is the farm to table movement,
Right.
definitely in California. Does that have like a parallel relationship with the Nouvelle Cuisine? Do you think like Nouvelle Cuisine in France kind of sparked it, or is it like
Yeah,
a
I think
parallel
that's
movement?
connected. I mean, it's the same time. If you think back to, I don't know, Chez Panisse, Alice Waters, early 1970s, there's a kind of like, first of all, Alice Waters was not a trained chef. Now that compare that to the men of in the French haute cuisine kitchens. They were all super trained, like they've been training as apprentices since they were teenagers. It was a highly regimented system. This was the system that the women chefs I was just talking about were excluded from. If you were a young woman in France in the 70s, early 70s, and you wanted to go do an apprenticeship at the Trois Gras restaurant, for example, you couldn't because it was men only. So Alice Waters was not a trained chef. She opened that restaurant. There was a kind of post-60s, a little bit of a hippie vibe going on in California around that, and that is connected to this Nouvelle Cuisine moment. This kind of liberating, li trying to liberate cooking and liberate the kitchen from all of these strictures. Yeah, and in fact, there's a little side. One of the people that I interviewed for this book was a man named Billy Cross, who had worked, or actually no, his boyfriend had worked. Michael James was his boyfriend. He was working at Chez Panisse, and they this was in the early 70s. They were and they started a they decided to start a cooking school together up in Northern California, and they would invite these great French chefs over to the States to teach these 1 week long, very extravagant cooking classes in on a winery in Napa. And so there was definitely a connection between that kind of California cool new cooking, farm to table, everything seasonal, everything fresh. That was definitely kind of philosophically, culturally connected to the Nouvelle Cuisine movement. Nouvelle Cuisine, the philosophy of Nouvelle Cuisine was absolutely the same. It was about freshness and seasonality and experimentation and just a kind of more freewheeling feeling in the kitchen. So, absolutely.
What I also noticed in the book, one of my favorite was like the diet fad a little bit, and especially like putting calories on a menu.
Yep.
And I didn't realize, like for me, like, oh, that was because like the health department in the US kind of mandated that, but that seemed to be, did you think that was like idea, like this was
Yeah,
a Nouvelle
well,
Cuisine
okay,
thing?
Nouvelle Cuisine, one of the things that it was experimenting with was it was healthier. It was fresher. The food was fresh, the food was healthy. They were very, very scornful, for example, of covering up a piece of meat or a piece of fish with some incredibly rich, heavy sauce, which was, the cliche of French haute cuisine. You'd go to the restaurant, you have your sole, your fish, and then there would be a big, a sort of a sauce. They were absolutely against sauces. They were against these thick, rich sauces. And so it became, and you have to think back to this moment in the early mid 70s. This was a moment when people were, I mean, I remember I grew up, I mean, I was a child, a small child in the early 70s, but I remember my parents cooking, baking, my mom was baking bread in, for us, and buying food at the food co-op in Berkeley, California. And this was all part of the kind of the in the back in the ether at the time. So yeah, I do think there's a connection there.
What I also thought, like the difference between Nouvelle Cuisine, which predated, which before haute cuisine, was like the role of the critic. And I wonder if you could talk about like the role of the critic in terms of food consumption, media, and how did they play a role in the chef's
Yeah, I mean,
lifestyle?
it's interesting also to
Yeah.
think about how, there okay, there was there have always been, or in the post-war period, there were restaurant critics at major newspapers, let's say.
Yes.
Craig Claiborne at the New York Times was like the godfather, the dean of the American food world. And he wrote restaurant reviews for the New York Times, but he was pretty much the only one. No, there were maybe a few others, and in France it was the same. There was Robert Courtine at Le Monde, who was the all-powerful food critic, and by the way, the villain of my book. Fascinating character. Always good to have a villain in a story like this. But this also, this moment of Nouvelle Cuisine is also the time when the kind of food publicity around food was invented. Go and Millau were two French newspaper writers who sort of cottoned onto this at the time and realized food and restaurants were hot. People were talking about new restaurants. This was exciting. They, in fact, coined the idea of Nouvelle Cuisine. They wrote a manifesto in their magazine saying, "This is what Nouvelle Cuisine is. Here are the 10 commandments of Nouvelle Cuisine. It should always be fresh, no more heavy sauces, et cetera, all the rules, quote unquote, rules of Nouvelle Cuisine." And this was a glossy magazine, hugely successful magazine. The food magazine. What are the top 10 bistros in Lyon? Where should I go? What are the new restaurants in Paris? All this kind of stuff. And they were taking on the kind of hegemonic Michelin Guide, which was this the had been around forever. The Michelin Guide. The Michelin Guide basically is a listing of restaurants, and the only editorial in that book is the star system. So they have, you can be listed without a star, or you can have one, two, or three stars. That's the Michelin system, and that's it. It lists if you're a great restaurant, and you're listed in the Michelin Guide. It just lists your ad the address of the restaurant, and it lists how many stars you got, and it might list, okay, here are some of the items on the menu that are specialties of the house, kind of thing, and that's it. There's no writing, there's no voice, there's no attitude. Go and Millau decided we're going to create a guidebook that's going to compete with the Michelin Guide, but it's going to be fun. It's going to have attitude. It's going to have opinions, and that's what they brought to it. So that was very very much a product again of this moment in the culture of the late 60s, early 70s, where food became part of the popular culture in a way. And another character that I wrote about in my book and interviewed and who was absolutely wonderful is Janu Kolar. She invented the idea of the publicity, the PR person for a restaurant, which hadn't really existed until then. And so she represented a lot of these chefs and got them great publicity. And, Paul Bocuse is on the cover of Newsweek magazine in the 70s, all this kind of publicity. She was very connected in Hollywood as well. And, was one of the sort of people promoting the idea that chefs, not that chefs should be celebrities, but that there was a kind of glamour attached to being a chef. And that's sort of the shift that had happened. She was part of making that happen.
And that's like something that we see today. Mostly guy, like I think a Guy Fieri is like definitely more of a comical take, but like Anthony Bourdain, that's definitely the trend that we still see today. And
Oh,
like definitely
absolutely.
because
I
there are
mean,
a
I
lot of
think
women,
exactly the origins of our kind of food media complex go back to this. At the end of my book, I introduced the idea. This is in the 80s. Paul Bocuse created the Bocuse d'Or, which was a his idea was cooking should it would be like an Olympics of cooking. So you would have national teams, the American team, the Swiss team, the German team, whatever. These teams would all come to Lyon, which is where he was based, and they would and this would happen every few years. It wouldn't be every year, and they would compete to be the to be to and they would be given challenges like, okay, you must create, you have 1 hour to create the dinner with the this chicken and these ingredients or whatever it was. So this is like, you know, and now again, our culture is just, you know, everywhere you look, there's a food cooking competition on television. But this was also this was new. This was something that also goes back to you know, this period where cooking became part of the culture in that way.
I'm thinking of like, like Gordon Ramsay's like very Americanized, very yelly kind of American show. But I'm like, oh yeah, that's I always get a kick out of that one. But my next follow-up question is, especially when your book talks about like the underdogs, the women, do you think novella cuisine, like kind of that philosophy, also kind of correlated with women's liberation in the movement, especially in the 70s?
Yeah,
And
well,
if
I
you could
think
talk
the
a lot more about that.
ARC, which was the group of women chefs that I write about, who were excluded from these institutions, you know, the organization of French chefs or whatever, they were excluded. And that was they were definitely influenced by, they weren't super political. They were just women who ran restaurants who wanted to be recognized for what they were doing. But at the same time, the leader of the Nouvelle Cuisine movement was Paul Bocuse. Paul Bocuse was like the most famous of all of these chefs. He was the guy who was first and foremost, he was the guy who was on the cover of Newsweek or whatever. And he was just a classic French chauvinist, like the kind of guy who would say, you know, he was a very charming, flirtatious guy. But he loved to say things like, women can't cook. You know, I'd rather have a woman in my bed than, you know, in the kitchen. This kind of like slightly sarcastic 1950s style sexism came very naturally to him. And he was, you know, he relished being the provocateur. He
Oh,
saw
wow.
himself as kind of a, you know, a rogue. He had many mistresses. He had illegitimate children, all this kind of this was his whole persona. And of course, as soon as the women of the ARC, when the women started this organization, the ARC, he immediately started attacking it, sort of half in jest, but also half seriously. You know, why are the women, for example, the women of the ARC posed in Paris Match magazine wearing their white chef's toques, you know, the chef's hat, which they didn't normally wear, but for the photo shoot they did. And Paul Bocuse wrote a letter after he saw that, saying, "How dare these women use the toque? The toque is only for men." You know, it was tongue in cheek, but it was also trying to be provocative. So absolutely, the politics are complicated. I mean, let's just say that at the outset, because I already referred briefly to Robert Courtine, the villain of my story, who's like an arch conservative. He's the powerful food critic. He hates Nouvelle Cuisine because Nouvelle Cuisine is experimental and Nouvelle Cuisine is breaking the rules and Nouvelle Cuisine is not the kind of old school French cooking that he likes. And he latches onto the women of the ARC and says, "These women, these are this is the kind of cooking I like." So it's a complicated situation where you have these women who are sort of, yes, pursuing a women's liberation, pursuing a kind of feminist approach, trying to get recognized for their and be allowed to create their own organization. And eventually, by the way, they are allowed to join that French that the chef organization sometime in the 80s. It takes a while. But they have allied themselves with this very conservative guy who has a dark history. You know, he's basically a fascist. Which that the truth about him sort of slowly trickles out over the course of the 70s and 80s. And that's a you know, big part of the story that I'm telling too. So it's not a simple, you know, story of Nouvelle Cuisine was good or bad. You know, it was definitely a reflection of this time of experimentation, and And it coincided with these women chefs who were also doing experimenting and opening trying new dishes and so it's the political story is a little bit of a complicated one, but very fun to write about.
The one kind of couple more questions, and then Luke here will do us a little reading from his book. Where do you think the future of French cooking is going to land now, post Nouvelle, and then like into the 21st century onwards,
You
as
know,
we're
that's
kind of on
so
our
people
way?
ask me this. I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer. I think what happened was, okay, so Nouvelle cuisine is in the 1970s. There's been m much more recently, if you think back to like the Noma restaurant, for example, which is in the news these days, very controversially, or Elena Arzak in San Sebastian, Spain. There's a lot of there has been it, I guess it's called modernist cooking. This idea of very experimental, using chemistry almost. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been to one of these restaurants. I have actually, not very often, but I have had that experience of going into a restaurant and being served foam or some kind of strange concoction. Like it was like Pop Rocks, but they tasted like anchovies or, I mean, I've had like these crazy. So that was kind of a trend in the, I don't know, 2010s, 20 teens, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
That's very
I'm
much a
struggling
nouvelle
with
cuisine. You can see the
Yeah.
connection. Where things are going now, though, I mean, it's so interesting to think about. I'm not an expert on it since I'm
Yeah.
basically a food historian, effectively.
Yeah.
I'm not like I have friends who are, who write restaurant reviews or who are up to date on the latest restaurant news and so forth, and I'm not the person to ask about where it's all going. I'm more like, okay, where's my next story going to be? Where am I going to find a world where something interesting happened that I can try to bring to life in a novelistic way? And sorry, I haven't. I feel like I'm a novelist manqué in some ways. Like I want my books to feel like novels. So I'm always looking for a world where, in this case, it's the early 1970s. So much is changing in the culture. You're a young man, a young woman in this, Annie Devine is one of my characters, or Michel Girard, and they're opening their own restaurants, and how that felt and how exciting it was and what music was playing on the radio, all that kind of stuff. I want my books to feel novelistic in that way. So I'm always looking for a world that I can bring to life.
I know your book was just recently published, but do you have any back burner ideas coming up in the next couple of years or any
I
other?
have a new book I'm working
Good.
on, yes.
Oh, nice. Congratulations.
Yeah,
Awesome.
it's a whole different direction. It's going to be about sushi.
Oh my gosh,
So,
really?
yeah,
Are
it's
you
a
going to go to
different. My
Japan a lot now?
wife is Japanese, and I spent a lot
Oh.
of time in Japan over the years, so I'm excited about this new
I'm
book.
excited to hear about it. My last question before you do your reading is, what was your favorite French cuisine that either you really want to try that you research in your book or when you were doing your interviews when you're in France, if you have one.
There's a restaurant in Paris called Guy Savoy, and it was he's I interviewed him for the book. He's the next generation after the Nouvelle Cuisine generation, so he's kind of like a little bit younger, and that lunch was just unbelievable, really, really remarkable. So yeah, there is still an incredible food to be had. The other thing I mentioned, I tracked down these women of the ARC, and one of them is still cooking today. She's in her 80s, in the north of France, in a town called Vervins. And I did this long trek, on a train, on a bus, it was in November, raining. Got to this tiny little town where she has this beautiful little hotel and restaurant, and then she cooked me lunch, and then we sat down and ate together, and I interviewed her, and that was another very memorable
Oh, that's so
lunch.
sweet.
Yeah, she's
All right.
great.
Thank you, Luke. If you want to read a little bit of your excerpt and then
Sure,
we can
yes. Okay,
continue.
so this is just a short section about Michel Girard. Michel Girard was, in a way, the most brilliant of these chefs, at least amongst themselves, they all said that, and he opened a restaurant called Le Pot au Feu on the outskirts of Paris. So this was not downtown, not in a hot area. This was like in the outskirts of town, in a shabby neighborhood, a tiny little restaurant, and he was struggling to make ends meet. Listen, Michel, you're a little prick, a petit con, de Louvain called him, affectionately, of course. I see you here, and you're dying a slow death. But in the name of God, if you're going to die, at least die happy. Do what you truly want to do. He was talking about the food. Nothing wrong with a tiny, money-losing restaurant in a shabby neighborhood, as long as Girard was cooking what he wanted to cook. And de Louvain was right. What did he have to lose? Girard had opened Le Pot-au-Feu because he'd wanted to be independent, because he'd wanted to express himself. Not just to cook, but to create. All around him, he could feel it. Change was in the air. It was generational. Everyone was experimenting in literature, in film, in theater, on campus. It was about more than politics or sex or drugs or rock and roll or any one particular thing. It was existential, a new thinking about how to live, a new disdain for authority. Girard was living with a friend, a sculptor, on a barge docked on the Seine, and he wanted to import some of the bohemian energy of the city to his restaurant. He just needed to figure out how to do it and also stay in business. No more sandwiches, Girard declared. I'm going to do what I want. Girard changed the menu that very week. He changed everything, aiming for a pared-down simplicity that was nevertheless exciting, new. His dishes had no heavy sauces or unnecessary ornamentation. He served his house-made foie gras totally plain, no aspic, no truffles, no parsley, nothing at all. It was a statement of purity and of his own tastes and preferences. His vegetables were undercooked by the standard measure, brightly colored and with a bite to them. His chicken and duck were served in intensely flavored reductions with a hint of vinegar and no cream, just the sort of dishes he served his friends. Everything on the new pot-au-feu menu was light, fresh, and a bit provocative. The point was to break free of the past. He had every respect for the traditional preparations handed down from Auguste Escoffier over the decades, but he wanted to simplify and purify his cooking, to focus in a radical way on the ingredients themselves, to find new and elegant combinations of flavors and textures, new interpretations of classic dishes. Classical cuisine could be lifeless, inert, and apathetic, thought Girard. He was determined to be stubborn and to reject the traditional authority and whatever existed before. And without quite realizing it, he had opened a new avenue, a new path, that of the chef as an artist of sorts, an inventor, an auteur.
Thank you so much for that excerpt, Luke. And thank you, Luke, for being on the air tonight. Luke now has a recently released book, The Secret History of French Cooking, The Outlaw Chefs Who Made Food Modern. And thank you, Luke, so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, that was
Well,
fun. I appreciate your time.
thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.